This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. As always, I got Steve Smee joining me.
Good evening, everyone. Pre-Thanksgiving podcast. We have a great
pre-Thanksgiving, just in time to get two human nutrition masters on. Joining us today, we have IFBB Chris Tuttle. Chris, you have a master's in human nutrition, correct?
Yes, and my registered dietitian, which in America, that's like the credential you need to be able to practice nutrition inside hospitals, do tube feeds, TPNs, long-term care, that kind of thing.
How does it work in the U.S.? Here in Canada, you have to do an eight-month unpaid internship to get your dietitian degree. Is it the same in the U.S.?
It's a little more. You have to do your bachelor's degree in nutrition. Then you apply to an internship, which has become grossly competitive. Like, for example, in some places you get 150 applicants and they accept four.
What I was asking is it unpaid in the States too?
Actually, I had to pay $10,000 to work $1,500 for free.
It blows my mind how much they screw you in academia. Hey.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, some internships now they offer like stipends that might give you like $200 a week for food or whatever, but most of them now you have to pay for.
In Canada, most of them will at least cover your room and board, but it blows my mind that they're eight-month unpaid internships, and they're usually at hospitals, and they usually give the students, like, the worst times ever. Like, normally you'll be working, like, 4 a.m. till noon or shifts like that. Like, it's – and that's after you get your nutrition degree. So you have to do a four-year degree, and in order to get that registered dietitian – certification, then you also have to do this 8 month unpaid internship.
And then sometimes you get a bad preceptor and they make you do all this like gopher work that means nothing, and that work that they don't have to do, that you're not really learning anything, which I don't like. But I mean, I was lucky. I had some good preceptors that really like forced you to think outside the box and push you into situations where you really had to learn, versus like, here, just organize this paperwork, you know?
Yeah, and it sounds like you got a pretty good placement too, because, you know, a lot of people just end up working with seniors for 8 months and it's pretty boring.
Yeah, I was lucky. I did mine at Stony Brook Hospital University in Long Island, which is it's a teaching hospital, a big teaching hospital for residents and doctors. So I got to work alongside a lot of them. It's a very good program. It's actually one of the longest programs in the country, but I took it because I got in. I wasn't going to wait another year, you know?
Yeah, it's very, very competitive here in Canada too. Like, you'll have 1,000 people apply and they'll take like 10 to 20 people. It's very competitive.
Yeah, do you guys have to apply for a specific individual place, or does it go into a specific pot and then you get placed?
You have to apply to a specific place and you can't apply to another place until you hear back from that one place.
No.
Yeah, it's brutal, man.
Oh, see, I could apply to 30 different places if I wanted, and then I get to choose or pick or choose. And if you get accepted, it all gets accepted. It all tells you the morning of at like 4 a.m. And then you can be like, oh, geez, I'm going to pick this one and
go. Do you have any publications?
No.
Okay. So when you send your thesis or whatever meta-analysis, whatever you do, to a journal, you're not legally allowed to submit it to another journal at the same time, because it'd be a duplicate publication, right? So you can only submit it to one journal at a time. They're brutal. They take like 6 to 8 weeks to get back to you. And then, you know, they'll get back to you and they'll finally be like, we didn't like it. So basically, like, you wait 8 weeks and they finally get back to you and like, they'll be like, we appreciate the offer, but we're going to pass on this publication. And it's like, oh my goodness. And then you have to, you know, send it to a different journal. And hopefully that journal will be at least like, we like it, but we need these revisions done or whatever. Like, it's academia is hurry up and wait.
It's like that here, but most of people who get things published are PhDs, or it's for their PhD, and very similar. Like, you got to change this, got to change that. But I'm unaware about the legality purposes of it. You can't submit to another one, which that's beyond my knowledge here, but that sounds crazy there.
It makes sense if you think about it, because you wouldn't want duplicate publications in two journals, right? Because people pay for these journals.
Right, so right.
It makes sense if you think, like, I understand it. I just wish that they were faster. You know, like, I just got a major publication. I did a big meta-analysis and literature review on omega-3 supplements, right? And, you know, I got a publication. Luckily, I got it published in the first journal we submitted to. But, I mean, you submit it. You don't hear anything back for 4 weeks. You send them like a follow-up email like, hey, I was just wondering where you guys are at. Do you have like a ETA on when you're going to get back to me on if you're going to publish this or not? And then you get a bounce back email that says, I'm on vacation. I'm not accepting emails for the next 4 weeks. And it's like,
oh. Vacation for 4 weeks.
I don't know, man. Yeah. Anyways, that's enough academia venting. So Chris, IFBB Pro, obviously you're a very smart guy. Obviously, you know a lot about nutrition. Where would you say you learned most of your nutrition? Was that kind of just in the scenes, trial and error? Or would you say that, you know, your background has really, really helped you achieve that IFBB Pro status?
Obviously, just like anything, like, you know, you could read a book on how to climb Mount Everest and be well educated and versed on what it takes to climb it. But until you actually do it, is when most of the knowledge, you know, is really imprinted, and really the experience is what gives you that skill. I would say, honestly, it's the combination of everything together. I couldn't sit there and tell you my experience over my education. I can tell you my education has definitely broadened my horizons and made me able to see through bias more clearly, because I feel like a lot of people who aren't educated will attach themselves to a concept and see things more black and white. I think my experience, my personal experience with competing and helping clients with my background in nutrition has made me able to see things outside the box and apply things and be open-minded, because, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of coaches out there and people who do nutrition who are all one way and won't be willing to see any other way, which I think is the biggest downfall with a lot of nutritionists and dietitians today, is they're all one way. Like in America, we are taught, you know, the food guide pyramid, which is now my plate, right? So you get a lot of dietitians who only teach my plate, and that's it, because that's what they're taught, and they won't think outside the box and changing, well, this person's endomorphic, they might be better off following a lower carbohydrate diet than somebody who's not. And they won't see that, because that's not what research supports in their internship they've learned. Do you see what I'm saying? So one
thing I want to pick your brain on, let's use milk for an example. So a lot of nutritionists, if they see you're an athlete, they'll recommend milk because, you know, milk on paper, good quality protein source, high in calcium, it's a fluid, so it'll rehydrate you after or before your event. You know, it is high in sugar, but again, you know, if it's post-workout, you know, those sugars are going to replenish glycogen levels, things like that. On paper, milk seems like a good option. However, I know myself, if I drank a glass of milk, I'd feel horrible, I'd feel bloated, I'd feel gassy. So milk, for example, do you drink milk? Do you incorporate that into, you know, any of your clients' programs? Like, I'm just trying to, like, that difference between what works on paper and that kind of real world of experience of, you know, milk and dairy products is in general, I find most people, if they aren't lactose intolerant, will have a severe lactose sensitivity and will feel much better and have a much tighter midsection removing dairy products from their diet.
I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. Do I incorporate milk into most of my clients' plans? I do not. My general weight loss clients, who are just, you know, general everyday people who are trying to lose weight, be more balanced, I will give them a cereal option. I'll always write next to it, not the best option for meals, for staying full or controlling blood sugars or energy. I will state that. I generally don't like, I don't put milk in my diet. I mean, I like milk. Don't get me wrong. Nothing wrong with, like, have a cookie and a glass of milk. It's great. But I definitely don't incorporate that into my general plan, nor do I think that's the best option for a post-workout, really, for any athlete. I mean, does it work? Yeah, it works, but it's not the ideal.
I agree with you. And I do the same. Like, training a competitor and training the general public is very, very different. You know, with a competitor, It's very specific. You know, it's, I want you to eat these foods because of these exact reasons. But with someone just trying to lose weight, I do exactly what you say. You know, I have lots of different food options, and then I list them, you know, best choices, medium choices, choices only to pick once in a while. You know, bread, for example, whole wheat bread really isn't the best carbohydrate choice. But at the same time, someone who's just trying to lose weight, if it's, you know, a Saturday morning and he wants to have some toast with his kids, having a couple slices of bread isn't going to kill him, right? So it's exactly like you said, is people really need to understand big picture with this stuff. And there's no good or bad food. You know, there's just foods that you should eat in limited quantities.
Right. And like, I'm glad you said that, because people will attach themselves like, oh, like, you know, I give them a plan. They go, I can have white rice. I'm like, white rice is not bad. If you're going to compare white rice to brown rice and you're only eating rice with no other fat or protein with it, of course, its glycemic index and its glycemic response is going to be, is differ. But when you're consuming with a fat and a protein and you like jasmine white rice, and it's going to make you more able to adhere to a plan, then that's what you're going to go with. Like you said, you're not going to be eating rice 15 times a day all day. And being more realistic will increase someone's adherence to a program, provided that they're just general weight loss, general population.
Do you know what leptins are? I'm going to say one more thing that I know Steve wants to chime in. Do you know what leptins are?
Yes.
They're basically anti-nutrients in foods, right?
Yeah.
I've had a lot of people argue with me that white rice is actually better for you than brown rice because there's no leptins in it, and your body digests it much better.
I agree. I have ulcerative colitis and I have Crohn's, all right? And I can't tolerate brown rice. I can't tolerate most carbohydrates. I can tolerate jasmine white rice. Digestibility is fine. I don't get bloated. Obviously, rice is not gas forming. I used to do brown rice, but generally brown rice, it's, if you're trying to bulk, trying to gain, eating 2 cups of brown rice is difficult, you know? Eating a cup and a half, 2 cups of jasmine white rice is much easier, in my opinion, digest better.
And if you look at the nutrition facts, literally it's like a gram or two of fiber. You know what I mean? Like you could have half a stick of broccoli to make that up.
Yeah.
Steve, I'll let you chime in. I know you want to ask some questions.
Yeah, there's a lot I want to definitely talk about. You know, we'll get into the food stuff, but you just mentioned Crohn's disease. And I've met so many people who've been diagnosed with Crohn's disease. Can you just, you know, we talked about it, I think, on one podcast. We've done like almost 200 podcasts. We talked about Crohn's disease on one podcast. And I think that's a grave, unfortunate thing that we haven't talked more about this. Can you talk about really quick what Crohn's disease is? How did you find out you had it? And what have you done to kind of overcome it?
All right. So I will first tell you this. I don't have any family history of ulcerative colitis, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's are irritable bowel diseases. It's different from IBS. All right, we'll make that clear for the listeners. They're both inflammatory diseases, of course. Now, I have no family history of it anywhere. I don't have any Jewish ancestry in my family, so genetically, I shouldn't have it. I totally brought it on by the lifestyle I live and the high stress, go, 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 lack of sleep over extended period of time, because generally people who have flare-ups have a lot of stress or a stressful event or traumatic event in their life. I started to experience issues in my digestive system, you know, mucus, blood, frequent stools, frequent visits, bloating, gas, fatigue, fever, for a period of time. And then I finally got a colonoscopy. Long story short, the doctor did a biopsy and he said, the biopsy is kind of inconclusive. He goes, you have all the symptoms of ulcerative colitis and your biopsy is positive for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. He goes, your typical symptoms and signs don't really match Crohn's, but your biopsy says you have both. Basically, you have mass amounts of inflammation that's going on in your intestinal tract. And he goes, you know, recommend all these meds and stuff. And my insurance here didn't cover it. It was like $1,000 a month. So I'm like, you know what? And I did try the meds for a little bit. It didn't work. So I really kind of changed my lifestyle, reduced stress, changed my diet, which I'll get into. But I more or less have more symptoms of ulcerative colitis when I was having flare-ups, which is anywhere from 8 to 16 visits to the toilet, which is straight mucus, blood, very little stool, periods of diarrhea, to constipation, fatigue, dry sweats, fever. You feel horrible. Appetite just disappears because you're afraid to eat, of course. And when you have flare-ups, you always think every food you eat is causing the flare-up. Obviously, things like anything that's a GI irritant, garlic, onion, you know, the FODMAP foods tend to have.
So you pretty much got to eliminate foods that are causing you to have these flare-ups.
Honestly, you got to eliminate everything. I was down to just plain chicken with salt, limited amount of rice, and oil, because oils, you know, make the intestinal lining slippery.
Chris, I want to ask you your opinion on FODMAPs, you know, because a lot of foods have FODMAPs that a lot of people consider clean foods, you know, things like potatoes, nightshades, bell peppers, tomatoes. For someone with Crohn's, do you think those foods would cause a flare-up, even though they're considered, you know, quote-unquote clean foods?
Not necessarily. With IBD, it's a total individual basis. I've had clients who tolerate most foods that you and I would think would be a problem for anybody with any mild GI issues, and you have others who can't tolerate almost anything. It's a total individual thing. I can tolerate tomatoes, avocados, I can tolerate bananas, I can tolerate even wheat bread. I can't tolerate a fourth cup of oats. Oat bran, sweet potatoes, potato, skin, broccoli, I can't tolerate most vegetables. So it's a real individual thing, and I think FODMAP, you know, it gives people a categorical way to navigate through their nutrition to try to eliminate problem foods, but you can't umbrella all those foods together and say they're all bad for people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
What are your thoughts on food sensitivity tests in order to see what foods might be problematic for you?
Define the test, like IgG?
An IgG antibody blood test.
I don't think they're incredibly accurate.
Really?
Because the bottom line is this: if you're eating foods and you feel fine, you have no problems, no sign symptoms, your energy's fine, your gas is fine, and here you are, come back with five positive tests for some sort of mild reaction to, say, asparagus. It's like, am I going to eliminate asparagus from my diet because there's some type of mild reaction in my blood that no real solid research has supported that that is something that could be causing mass amounts of inflammation or damage? I don't buy into that. Now, if you're experiencing a lot of these issues and you're getting, you know, a lot of IgG positive tests and the markers are kind of high, then I would suggest possibly removing them. But I've seen some naturopaths here in America, you know, run these blood tests and tell these people that they're basically almost allergic to everything. But they're all like, well, I feel fine, but my naturopath says I can't have any of these foods or any of these foods, and I have to eat ostrich eggs, and I can't eat this, and I can't eat that. And I'm like, that just seems funny to me, you know? I really think that sometimes you got to look at the test in the big picture as a whole and make your decision based on what is going on. You know, like, remember when people used to say, well, high protein diet's bad for your kidneys because your EGFR can go up and your kidneys are working harder. Well, because your kidneys are working harder doesn't mean you're damaging your kidneys.
What about the whole candida thing? It seems like if you go to one of those holistic doctors, they'll always say you have candida.
Chris, give us your thoughts on candida and also probiotic supplements, because whenever you go to some sort of natural health store, they're going to say you have candida. For our listeners, that's basically an overgrowth of yeast in your digestive tract. And then they'll say, in order to get rid of the candida, you need to eliminate sugar from your diet and you need to start taking a probiotic supplement. That's kind of like the candida sales pitch 101.
Yeah, I don't know how it is in Canada. Do you guys have a lot of holistic and naturopathic doctors?
It's becoming more and more popular. I'd say, especially in the last 10 years, it's really, really become popular. Probably about the same as the States. I mean, when it really comes down to it, Canada and the US is the exact same. Just we have a way crappier military and we say sorry a lot more.
I don't know. Naturopaths here are getting out of control. Everybody's seeing a naturopath for everything. Candida, I mean, do I think you need to take a probiotic to address candida? Not necessarily. I like foods. I like sauerkraut, fermented foods. I think those digest better. I think they're a better source of
problem. The problem with things like that, though, Chris, is if you go to the grocery store, just like your regular grocery store, it's all dead. It's all pasteurized, right? You have to go to Yeah, you have to go to like a natural food store to get like a real probiotic sauerkraut or real probiotic kefir or pickles or things like that. So that's the main issue is like, I agree with you. Like, I think sauerkraut is awesome. You know, I think it's something people should be eating daily. But, you know, most people, they hear sauerkraut, they go to Walmart, they buy, you know, some jarred sauerkraut for $1.50 that's been sitting on the shelf for 3 years thinking it's doing them some good when it's doing nothing at all.
Because we have a lot of that in our grocery stores here, the unpasteurized raw sauerkraut.
Really?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, there's like the Whole Foods by us has like 10 different brands.
Okay, well, we don't have Whole Foods in Canada.
Yeah, when Trevor comes down to visit me, I'm going to take him to Whole Foods so he can see what a real grocery
store is. We're going to film it. It's going to be like a five-year-old let loose at a Toys R Us. I'm going to be like, oh, Steve, like, you guys have this? Like, oh man, I read about this. I didn't know this was real. I'm gonna be like touching everything to make sure I'm not hallucinating. And
it's a great store, man. It's a great store. But back to Candida thing. Yeah, I've had a few clients with Candida, you know, and I usually address it through diet, not supplements. You know, we do limiting the sugar in the foods, and sometimes people get better. But sometimes I feel like it's a multifaceted issue. There's a lot of other things going on because rarely does somebody just have Candida. They have a lot of other issues going on, health issues. And obviously, you know, whatever naturopath has them, all these supplements, they have them take and buy from the store. I'm not too incredibly well-versed in Candida besides the diet aspect of it. But I've never really addressed it right off the rip with probiotic.
But are you taking like kombucha and stuff like that to help with your Crohn's?
No, I do. So I do like 25 grams of sauerkraut 4 times a day.
So you get that from Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good tip. And, yeah. I don't know, Trevor, you want to ask anything else before?
Let me ask one more thing. Yeah. What other food sources of probiotic do you get and really recommend besides the sauerkraut?
I don't, because I feel like, you know, obviously some of the other foods do have some good probiotic sources, but I feel like most people won't eat them, or they're not as tolerable or expensive. Sauerkraut mixed in with like a little bit of ground beef, you know, it tastes really good. You add a little low sugar ketchup, people enjoy eating it. I think a lot of the clients that I have that I end up telling them about it, they end up loving it. They're like, oh my gosh, this is really good. I didn't realize how good this was, you know, because I mean, think about it. The first time I started eating sauerkraut, I'm like, this is stuff I used to put my hot dogs, you know, when I was a kid, you know, and here I am buying it again and adding it to chicken or beef. But no, I usually just use sauerkraut.
Oh, I'm German, man. I've been eating sauerkraut since I was 4. Another really good thing for our listeners is kimchi, which is basically a Korean sauerkraut. It's pickled cabbage as well, but it has a little bit more of a spice to it. So that's another thing to try, especially if you like things like hot sauce. You'd probably really, really like kimchi. And you can also buy probiotic pickles. You know, a lot of people like pickles.
Yeah.
So that's another option. Steve, I'll let you ask some questions, and then I want to pick Chris's brain about protein supplements.
Yeah, this is kind of a, goes hand in hand with the protein thing too. I'm curious what you think, Chris, about the whole anabolic window. Because I was watching some funny videos today with a bodybuilder, like a character walking around and asking girls out, and he's like, you know what? My anabolic window starts in 45 minutes. Do you want to grab something to eat? He was just kind of like making a comedy skit. I don't know if you've seen it on YouTube, but I thought that was funny because so many people, they go work out and then they run, they like sprint to the protein bar and they're like, protein, give me protein shake. Give me protein shake. Like their muscles are going to evaporate if they don't run and get a protein shake.
Steve, that's a great pickup line. Next time I see a cute girl at the gym, I should be like, hey, so I just finished my workout. I got about an hour until my anabolic window is going to close. I was wondering, you know, would you like to go grab a bite to eat? Or what are your thoughts on the anabolic window, Chris?
From what I understand, the most recent research I read was, I think it's been 2 years now. There's a study done by a bunch of doctors here, and it was in regards to muscle wasting in elderly patients. And protein timing and how to maximize protein synthesis in sedentary elderly patients to maintain muscle mass and survive, you know, better be able to survive cancer. Because obviously the amount of muscle mass an elderly patient has can dictate morbidity, mortality rate, survival, and cancer and other diseases, right? So they're speculating that having regular intervals of protein, say 25 grams of protein 4 times a day, in regular intervals maximize protein synthesis. And same sort of group of studies, they're also saying that you have a strongest protein synthesis response within 25 to 40 minutes post-workout. It doesn't mean that you're not going to have a protein synthesis response if you wait an hour. Are we going to sit there and be able to see this, a difference, you and I? Never, but probably in a blood lab, in a lab, in a clinical setting, you could draw blood and see a difference, but I don't think you would ever equate to anything you're going to see. Does that make sense?
And another thing too, another joke is the whole, like, I need like 500-600 grams of protein a day type of thing. Oh. I need 3 times my body. How much protein do you really need as a weightlifter or as a fitness, someone into fitness per body weight, grams per body weight?
From what I understand, the max amount of protein your body can actually metabolize and use, even in a severely burned victim, is up to 2.2 to 2.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, which is not that much. And sometimes that can even be overkill. However, I mean, obviously, I don't know if you guys have worked in the hospital ICU. Sometimes you get people with metabolic diseases or muscle wasting where you're dumping 300 grams of protein in the TPN, I mean, in a tube feed total and TPN together, and they're still wasting away because you're trying to prevent them from wasting. Yeah.
A healthy, just a normal Joe who works out at the gym, how much protein should we be getting if you're 200 pounds?
And now, are we eating sufficient amount of calories and carbs and protein too? I mean, proteins and fats too?
Yeah, I mean, just like say you're eating like a normal diet, like how much protein should you aim for in that situation?
I would say 1 gram per pound of body weight, provided that you're not fatter than 15% body fat.
Basically 200 grams. I'm gonna add on a couple of things to what Chris has said. So generally, yeah, I agree with him. You know, 1 gram per pound of body weight is more than enough. Like, you're actually, that's more than you need, but I mean, it'd be better to be a little bit on the safe than sorry side. So if you're 200 pounds, shoot for 200 grams. The only time that changes is that if someone has some sort of digestive issue, like a leaky gut or something like that, so they're not actually absorbing all of the protein they're eating. But again, that's like 0.001% of the population with a severe medical condition. And one thing that hasn't been tested is protein requirements for people using steroids, because obviously steroids enhance muscle protein synthesis. Anyone who tells you the protein requirements of an enhanced athlete is just guessing, because it's something that's never been studied in literature. I would guess, though, that if you're using steroids, you could probably absorb and utilize more protein. I would say maybe 1.5 grams per pound of body weight for someone using steroids. And even that's probably on the higher end than is really needed. But that's just my hypothesis. It's something that no one really knows. Chris, do you recommend higher protein intakes for people who are gearing?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you do, to be safe, like you stated. I think a lot of people do overkill it. I think 1.5 grams per pound, like I said, provided they're not fat, of course, because you get guys who are, you know, 220 pounds and they're 20% body fat, it's a different story. But if they're, you know, relatively lean, that's what I probably recommend. But it's hard sometimes, like, you know, you're justifying to somebody like a bodybuilder, because most of them won't do it. If you tell an enhanced athlete who's 200 pounds, you're like, you need to eat 200 grams of protein a day, and you divide that into 6 meals, they're like, well, I'm only eating like 3.5 ounces of protein per meal. They're not going to listen to you, you know?
Here's another problem with human studies, Chris, is that so we just did a very extensive research study where we compared milk to whey protein to placebo. The placebo was maltodextrin, right? So everything was isocaloric. So everything contained the same amount of calories. Obviously, the milk had a moderate protein content. The whey protein had the highest protein content. The maltodextrin had zero protein. We wanted to test this in athletes. So in order to, like, there's a huge eligibility, there's a lot of criteria you had to meet in order to be eligible for the study. But you had to be weight training for at least 5 years. So these are people who have been in the gym, they know how to train, they weren't newbies, right? The problem we found is that even though we tried to make it randomized and, you know, controlled and tried to make all the supplements look and taste the same. People aren't idiots. Anyone who's used a protein supplement knows what a protein supplement tastes like, the texture. And then people who have used a maltodextrin supplement, they know what it looks like. They know what it tastes like. You can't make a maltodextrin supplement look and taste exactly like a whey protein. So the people in the maltodextrin group knew that they're getting maltodextrin. So as soon as they went home, what's the first thing they're going to do? They're going to eat more protein because they know they're in that maltodextrin group, which obviously bastardizes all the results. So it's exactly like you said, you know, if you try to tell a bodybuilder, hey, I want to see how little protein you need in order to still build muscle, he'll say, screw you. I'm not taking part in this study.
Well, I got two things for that, right? So I always underate the amount of protein that people generally recommended you do. All through my amateur career, I ate 4 ounces of meat per meal as a bodybuilder. I competed as a light heavyweight, and a heavyweight, only eating 4 ounces of protein per meal. And I got in shape for the Jay Cutler Classic in 2012, which I won the overall, eating 4 ounces of protein per meal to prove a point. That you could do that, get in shape, be shredded, keep the muscle. I was able to obviously keep a higher amount of carbohydrates intake because my protein was lower, but it was still possible and I didn't lose any strength.
Just playing devil's advocate though, you're juicing for that show and steroids prevent muscle loss. So if a national athlete did that, I don't think you'd have the same results.
Right. But what I'm just saying is like people need that, you know, you need to do 8-10 ounces of protein, you're going to lose muscle. Because let's be honest, the people who were more worried to lose muscle are people who are juicing than people who are natural.
The people who are worried of losing muscle never show up in shape.
Yeah, 100%. People who are worried about being flat end up fat.
When I have a pre-contest client and they're in the last 6 weeks or something, I will purposely not, like, I'll know their macros, but I won't send it to them. And I'll say, whatever you do, don't calculate your calorie and your macro intake. Because as soon as, you know, a big guy sees, oh my goodness, I'm only eating, you know, 1600 or 1800 calories per day, they're going to go, I'm losing muscle, and they're going to start cheating. But it's, that's what you need to get to.
It's so funny you say that, because the mind and your outlook and knowing what you're eating freaks people out. They're like, I did my calories and I'm only eating so little. Like, I'm like, you didn't know this a week ago. This wasn't a problem, you know?
So I'm curious, Chris, piggybacking on that. You know, we've talked about this on prior podcasts. I know, you know, I just want to pick your brain. Why do you think the whole protein myth exists? Because I know on message boards, when I first started message boards about 12 years ago, and someone came on the message board and posted their diet, if they weren't eating at least 400-600 grams of protein a day, they got flamed.
Steve, I'll answer your question. And then
No, I want to hear Chris's answer first. Fine. We've heard your answer before.
And then I'll explain the truth.
Well, I'm going to get to that one second, but I want to go back to what you said, Trevor, for a second. In my thesis for my protein supplementation, one of the studies was done with shot putters, right? And there's three groups. One was doing 0.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. One was 1.5, one was 2. Over 12 weeks, they all filled in the same amount of calories. So everybody was eating the same amount of calories, filled in with other carbohydrates or fats or various. So the calories are the same. At the end, the group with 0.5 had a negative nitrogen balance. Obviously, the other two groups have a positive nitrogen balance. There was no difference in body fat change, strength, or performance in the 12 weeks within the three groups.
One thing I just want to add on quick. He said kilograms. So that was 0.5 grams per pound of body weight in kilograms. Remember that 1 kilogram equals 2.2 pounds roughly. So that's a protein intake of about 2.2 grams per pound of body weight. That's very, very low.
And the researchers are just speculating that even though they're negative nitrogen imbalance, the body adapted and was able to conserve protein as much as it could to with maintain muscle mass, provide they're still at resistance training, and their caloric intake was still sufficient, which goes to kind of provide that like your body still has the ability to adapt. And what you said before about like, you know, if someone's enhanced, they're able to tolerate more protein. But if you took somebody who was weight training and you gave them Anadrol 50 milligrams a day and you gave them 1300 calories a day, they're going to get stronger. They're going to gain mass. So it's like the body does change and the body does adapt, where sometimes people are like, well, now that I do this, I have to triple my carb intake, I have to triple my protein intake to utilize this the most efficient way possible. But the body's much more adaptive than people think it is. But anyway, back to what you're saying about the protein intake. It's very simple. It's human nature. Everybody thinks more is better in every aspect. My biceps aren't responding. I need to train them 3 times a week. My chest's not responding. I need to do 20 more sets. I need to get better at running. I need to run 15 miles a week this week versus 5 last week. Well, we all know that you can't do that in any sort of standard of the word of progression to that extreme. And I think that people still, even though all the education's out there, all the coaches out there, the information's at our fingertips with Google and internet, I still get young people and older people who go, I need to eat. The guy at the gym told me I need to eat 300 grams of protein a day. I'm like, well, you're 150 pounds and you're not even a bodybuilder. So I really think that general notion of more is better is what makes sense to people. And that's why they can't let it go.
Here's my thoughts. Who owns magazines and who sponsors magazines?
Supplement companies.
Supplement companies. What's the number one selling supplement?
Protein powder.
As part of the publication I did where we compared protein supplements to milk and a placebo, in my literature review, I basically did a lot of research on supplement sales, how they've been increasing, how they've been decreasing. Protein powder is by far the number one selling supplement. Like 60% of all supplement sales are protein powder because everyone uses it. You know, children use it, seniors use it, you know, people who don't even exercise use it because they use it in smoothies and things like that. So basically where I think it comes from is the magazines, you know, especially bodybuilding magazines are sponsored by supplement companies. These supplement companies say, you know, you need to eat this much protein, you need this much protein. And, you know, they're pushing these protein supplements. And then people read these magazines, read these articles and go protein. And they get in their head where, you know, I need 1,000 grams of protein per day. Otherwise I'm not going to make any gains. Just marketing. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, how often have you seen like a 15, 16 year old kid go to a GNC, buy this huge thing of protein powder, and then you ask him, well, what's the rest of your diet look like? He has no idea. He thinks this protein supplement is gonna be, you know, the magic thing to solve all his problems. But if you ask him, you know, what'd you have for breakfast? He's like, some Pop Tarts, you know. If you ask him what he had for lunch, it's Subway or something.
I don't know. I see it differently as more of like a human nature thing, because think about general weight loss people who are
there's that too, you know, like
everybody,
especially
wants,
here in North America, we have this, you know, bigger is better mentality.
Or extreme people, like for example, I get weight loss people who come to me and like, they're not interested in building mass. They're not interested in protein powder. And the first thing they say is like, well, what about this diet? And it's like the cabbage diet, extreme diet. I'm like, well, what about just eating balanced and healthy? Like we've all learned in our life, people aren't interested in hearing that. They don't want to hear that. You know what I mean? It's like, you want to become rich and make money. Okay, you need to build a business, work this many hours, work. They don't want to hear that. They want a scratch and win ticket.
The funniest thing though, Chris, is you're preaching balance. Me, you, and Steve don't even have the slightest idea of what balance is, because we're all extreme. Anyone who's competed has a screw loose. You know, we're recording this podcast right now at 8:45 p.m. We're not working 9 to 5 hours. You know what I mean? Like, I've sent you emails at 6 a.m. that you replied to. Like, all three of us are extreme. I like, if someone asked me what normal feels like, I'd be like, I don't know. I can tell you. I've never done it. So I agree with you, but it's ironic that, you know, you're saying balance when us three are the opposite of balance.
Well, I guess we live an unbalanced lifestyle and have an outlook, but on nutrition, it's balanced. Like, we're not going to sit there and tell people they can only eat protein only or only fat, or you have to eliminate all these foods or these foods, like food groups. Like, nutrition is what we see, I think, more balanced is more of what I'm talking about.
So I want to ask now, what are your thoughts on whey protein supplements? Do you use them?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm surprised you said that with, you know, having Crohn's. Doesn't cause a flare-up?
Whey isolate digests like water to me. I have to use a certain way because obviously you and I know a lot of these protein companies, supplement companies are garbage. So, I mean, I tolerate certain proteins really well. Isoway, vanilla by Universal, I digest legitimately like water. And actually, when I was having the worst flare-ups, that was one of the only things that I could actually tolerate.
Interesting, because I know Steve, he can't tolerate any whey isolate. And I mean, like, we're talking legit whey isolates from reputable companies where it's actually a whey isolate. You know,
if I drink just like a half a cup of it, I gotta go outside and I dry heave. It's just like so bad.
Are you generally lactose intolerant?
Anyone? I was growing up, I had a lot of stomach issues, probably, you know, IBS type of issues. And then when I was a teenager, the doctors had me do a lactose test. And yes, I did come out lactose intolerant. So the answer is yes. And, you know, obviously, like, I don't consume much. I don't consume milk. Like, I was not consuming milk for many, many years. So maybe transitioning to whey protein kind of had that effect where I just could not tolerate. But maybe if I slowly introduced whey, a good quality whey isolate, like you said, I could possibly tolerate it. But for me, it just makes me feel inflamed. It makes me feel like shit. So I just,
you know, what's funny is, like, obviously you guys know Isopure, right? Nature's Best. It's a high quality protein powder, right? Right.
It's actually made by Glanbia. It's made by Optimum Nutrition, same company.
No, but I can't tolerate that. But I can tolerate Universal's Isoway vanilla. I can tolerate that, no problem. Whether there's something else in there, they're adding to it, that's a problem or not, I don't know. I can tell you, I have one client now who has ulcerative colitis really bad, who lost like 60 pounds of body weight. And we started the bare bones diet, and we eventually incorporated more and more foods as you can tolerate them and find out what works and what doesn't, because I do believe it's a very individual thing. And he's now tolerating whey, no problem. He can't tolerate red meat at all. But that's an example of like some sort of individuality with somebody with a severe case of IBD.
One thing I'm going to do, Chris, I just won my pro card. So now I've retired. I've had enough of competing. And I'm going to run a couple of dietary experiments because, you know, I have trained people who are paleo. I've trained people who are vegan. I've trained people who are vegetarian, but I've never done those diets myself. So just kind of for fun and to make myself a better coach, I'm going to try quite a few different diet styles. So the first thing I'm going to try is I'm going to try paleo. So I'm going to remove all dairy from my diet. I didn't consume any dairy to begin with, but I'm going to try eliminating protein shakes and seeing how I feel. This is hard for me because I get my protein supplements for free. And I'm a cheap guy. So, you know, knowing that I'm having to pay for one more meal every single day is like, man, like I'm like shooting myself in the foot. But I basically called up a couple friends. I said, hey, I'm going to try going paleo. Come on over. I'll give you all the whey protein supplements I have currently open for free. So I'm going to try that experiment and just see, you know, maybe I do it for 3 weeks. I notice no difference. Then I know, you know, I tolerate whey protein fine. And then I'm going to try going vegetarian for a couple weeks. And then I'm going to try going vegan for a couple weeks. I most likely think I'm going to hate going vegan and vegetarian, but I'm going to try it. And, you know, you never know. I have the opinion, you know, try everything once and it'll be an interesting experiment. I personally don't feel veganism is optimal for health because there is no vegetable source of vitamin B12. So that just kind of tells me like God wants us to eat animal products because otherwise there would be a vegan source of vitamin B12. And considering that's an essential vitamin, if there's no vegan source of it, that's just kind of
mind. Is it in dirt though, Trevor? Dirt? If you eat dirt, you get it.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to start eating dirt. Should I eat some leather while I'm at it?
Take your
like vegans always say, they're like, well, there'd be dirt on the fruit you eat, so you'd be getting vitamin B12. I'm like, really? You think prehistoric human would pick up a potato and not just like rub off the dirt? You think you would actually eat the potato with all the dirt on it? Like, come on, that's crap and you know it.
I have a lot of respect for that, Trevor. I do believe that, you know, it drives me crazy sometimes when you get a lot of coaches who have never competed before ever. And they're overweight or they're out of shape and there's dictating what people should do. I think that, you know, having the knowledge background, you know, obviously the credentials and being able to go through it yourself is the best way to be able to really teach and really bring people through that same sort of avenue. And I like that. I would agree with you. I think the paleo, you'll probably, honestly, if I was going to hypothesize, I think you might feel better. The vegan, definitely not for me. And I actually stopped helping vegetarians and vegans a while back. I just not interested in helping people do that. Not because I don't really believe in the sense of like, you know, their choices are choice, but controlling appetite, blood sugar levels, GI bloating, and getting them weight loss is a little more difficult. And I can't sit there and promise them results, not to mention, in my opinion, like, we're going to get mad at me saying this, a large number of people who do enter these vegan vegetarian diets have a lot more, you know, going on in their life with anxiety, depression, and, you know, extremeness in their personalities, which makes it a little more difficult for them to.
I just had a long-term client of mine. Basically, I did a video log leading up to my last bodybuilding show. And the girl who was staying with me and helped me do the filming, you know, backstage where I was pumping up and things like that, she's a vegan. She's actually an environmental engineer. So the reason she is vegan is for environmental reasons, not necessarily health reasons, but because we all know animal products are horrible for the environment, especially beef. But anyways, so this long-term client of mine watched the daily video log, and, you know, Kristen, she's absolutely gorgeous, right? So she basically emails me and goes, I'm thinking about trying a vegan diet. You know, I saw Kristen, it seems really cool. And I basically replied back, so is your goal to lose muscle, gain body fat, or both? I thought it was funny, at least.
That is funny.
Yeah. She's a good-looking girl, that Kristen girl. So, but I wanted to ask Chris, piggybacking on what he said, because he says he shops at Whole Foods. Like, my position, I did do the vegan thing. I'm mostly a pescatarian right now. I have the luxury of – basically, I have a freezer full of fish. So every day I can eat fish. But I want to ask you, the meat I do eat, like if I have beef, I'll get like grass-fed beef. That's step four. I'll get, you know, pastured, humane-friendly eggs. So I do the whole humane-friendly thing. So at least I'm eating humane-friendly animal byproducts. Is that something that you do, even though you're eating meat, or do you just not?
Well, now that my wife and I, we work a lot, we make enough money, and let me tell you, my food bill is outrageous, and I will wear the same old bratty piece of sneakers so I can buy organic free-range chicken. I value food more than anything, and I do buy organic free-range chicken. I buy grass-fed beef. I buy, you know, Atlantic side fish. I'm very into my food. I buy the highest quality things I can get at Whole Foods. I do believe in all of that. I do believe in local farms. I do believe in supporting that to get away from this whole industrial commercial, you know, slaughter, how they raise chickens normally, like the kind of Purdue kind of stuff. I'm all for that, 110%.
Chris, I can tell we'd be good friends. I'm the type of guy who will go to the farmer's market, drop $1,000 on organic free-range meats, and then go to Starbucks and steal the Splenda packets.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I tell Alexia, like, you know, I'm sponsored by Universal, you know, and like, I might have like 75 Universal shirts that I wear all the time, and people are like, They'll ask me to come out. Like, hey, man, you got to come out with us? I'm like, they're like, you can't wear a Universal shirt. I'm like, yeah, I am, because that's all I own, because I'm not buying any more shirts.
You have the one going out shirt.
Yeah, I have like two. I'm the same way.
So Chris, we don't have much time as podcasts. We have a lot of listeners. Most people here in the United States and even in Canada, let's face it, are fat. And I can't go anywhere, whether it be the beach, a theme park, the grocery store, Walmart, whatever, without running into a 30, 40, 50-year-old male who's fat, or in female. Everyone is fat around us. And I live in one of the more healthier parts of the country, and everyone is still fat. They're listening. They really want to get their shit together. They really want to lose weight. Everyone wants to lose weight. Very few people actually want to gain weight, you know? But like, what do you have to say to those people listening who are having a really hard time losing weight? And let's face it, it is difficult because we're bombarded with all this marketing. When you turn on the TV, every other commercial is for pizza or Subway or McDonald's or fast food or something. So we're constantly bombarded with all these advertisements. We drive and there's restaurants in every corner. I mean, what can you tell them, you know, to get them on the right track? What is, whether it be, you know, anything, you know, to help them out, to get them going in the right direction.
All right. Without going on an extreme tangent, I'll try to break this down into little bullet points. All right. Number one, don't ever start a diet that's unrealistic or too extreme. If you're trying to lose weight, don't try to lose weight at all in 30 days. You should be focusing on making changes to your diet that are realistic on a daily basis, that you like, that you tolerate, that you can sustain for a period of time. Weight loss will follow. Weight loss, in my opinion, should be anywhere from a pound to 2 pounds per 7 days. There's going to be weeks that you might not lose weight, and that's fine. It doesn't mean that you go crazy and cut your carbs out completely or do anything extreme. You're looking for a real life, realistic change, and for the long term. Other thing is, I get a lot of people who manipulate other people to fail. And I don't care. People always go, well, I feel bad not eating. I'm like, listen, live your own life. Do what makes you happy. Stop living other people's lives or what they're going to think of you. Because in the end of the day, what makes you happy is the most important. So if you don't want to go out and eat bad food, then don't eat bad food. Don't let people shame you into doing that. I think that's a huge issue, especially with a lot of women, other women be like.
And then tomorrow on Thanksgiving too, it's an issue. Because I know, like, I'm going to be going to a Thanksgiving dinner and they're going to be putting stuff in front of me. They're like, eat this, eat this.
Well, my family knows better. Let me tell you. But I tell people that realistic lifestyle diet, don't do anything too extreme. And the third one is you got to be very careful not to develop any poor relationship with foods, because a lot of people end up dieting, become very obsessive. They enter into like a little cyclic thing where they live by technicalities where, okay, well, tonight I'm going to overeat, so I'm not going to eat the whole day, and then I'll overeat, and then tomorrow I'll do extra cardio and cut my carbs back to make up for it. Then they get really hungry, and then they binge out, and it's become a cyclic effect. You can't enter into that poor relationship with food because you become obsessive, and then you go down that road, it's hard to come back. Hence why a lot of females who end up competing end up with eating disorders and body image disorders because of the extreme back and forth. And you have to, if you want something, there has to be a change. You can't just enter a diet, lose the weight, and expect to go back to your normal habitual diet and expect to keep the weight off. There has to be a permanent lifestyle change. So whatever change that is, it's got to be something that you like, something you tolerate, something that's realistic. It has to. People don't like to wait. They're impatient. But if you don't have patience, you're ultimately going to fail.
Chris, we're at our time limit here, so I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'll let you, and then I'm going to close up the show. The only thing I'm going to add to what Chris said is have fun. You know, yeah. Like I see all these people and they're doing these bodybuilding shows and they're competing and they seem miserable. It seems like, you know, it's like going to the dentist for them. And it's like, then why are you even doing it? You know, like the whole point of, you know, bodybuilding and following a healthy lifestyle, it's supposed to enhance your life. It's supposed to make your life better. You know, don't get me wrong. The last couple of weeks of a pre-contest diet, you're going to be tired. You're going to be brain dead. You're going to feel like a walking zombie. But if you aren't enjoying this, don't do it. Life's too short to do something that makes you miserable, you know? So have fun with it and don't be scared to laugh at yourself. You know, like if you screw up, laugh at yourself, joke, you know, like just be like, well, that was stupid. And then just move on. Don't like another thing I see is I see someone will cheat on their diet and then for 3 weeks, they will stress about it and beat themselves up about it.
Yeah.
Done. Learn from it. Move on. You know, there's no point crying over spilled milk. So, Chris, you're obviously a very, very smart guy. You obviously know what you're doing. If someone is interested in contacting you for a program, more information about your training services, things like that, what is your website?
TotalNutrition.com.
So that's TUTTLE nutrition.com.
That is correct.
Okay. Chris, if you're ever in Canada, let me know and we'll get a workout in.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Where do you live in Canada?
I live in Winnipeg.
Oh, absolutely. Are we going to Canada next year? Yeah, we're going to Canada next year probably. I'll look you up for sure, man.
Do you know where you're going?
Lex, where are we going?
It was Toronto, but we can change it. Lexi
goes, it was Toronto, but we can change it.
No, I can... I'm literally in a different city every month. So, I mean, I'll probably be in your area anyways.
All right. Awesome.
Only thing I'll say about Canada is if you're coming in the winter, bring a warm coat.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
We actually have warnings released by Health Canada here in Winnipeg that it's so cold to not go outside.
Really? Like people actually freeze to death?
Like you could literally freeze to death if like you aren't, like it's literally that cold. Where it's so cold, you will go into shock and faint and then pass out and die from freezing to death. Like it gets that cold.
Oh my gosh. Well, I won't be going in the winter.
Free healthcare though. So if luckily if someone finds you, at least they'll revive you back to life for free.
Oh man, the healthcare here now is a mess.
Oh, don't even. We actually, evolutionary.org, it's a huge bodybuilding forum. They sponsor the show. And we just had a thread post where we went on this little tire and they're like, if I was president of the United States, I would make steroids legal. I think this whole illegality of steroids is stupid. I'm like, if I was president of the United States, I'd be fixing the healthcare mess long before I'd be worrying about, you know, making steroids legal. Like,
oh, absolutely. Dude, you ready for this? So, like, obviously, you know, real quick, I know we're closing up. I'm going to be paying $550 per month starting January 1st for healthcare just for me with a $7,500 deductible on the new universal healthcare plan.
It's crazy.
The more, because if you make money, you get charged more. So, like, this guy at the gym makes good money, so he's paying $3,000 a month for healthcare. You make under a certain amount, you might pay $50, no deductible. The bottom line in America, people in America have no self-responsibility for their own health, and we're so unhealthy as a nation that the cost of healthcare being universal would probably ultimately be impossible.
That's why when people make fun of me for spending so much money on food, supplements, things like that, I always say, you can pay for your health now, or you can pay for it later.
Absolutely. 100% agree.
For your host, Trevor Kuritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, IFBB Pro, Chris Tuttle, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.